Welcome to the show, ESPN 102.5 The Game, the Luke Rogers Brain Gall, and that sound means one thing and one thing only. Buck Rising joining us on the program. Demi Lovato, correct? Did I get that name? Did I get that name right? I'm not.
Can't believe I did that.
I'm very out of touch, Buck. Thank you for joining us, sir. How are you, buddy?
I am so much better now that I've heard the sweet, sweet sounds of Demi Lovato, and I have my coffee. I'm ready to go.
All right, so Matt LaFleur, Dean Pease, both sort of had their chance to sort of speak to the media yesterday for the first time. Just your general perception, and did we learn anything yesterday from either one of these two guys?
Well, we learned that Dean Pease was not forced to retire, that he did not leave Baltimore on any kind of contentious terms, although I don't know if you guys saw the comments from the Ravens owner, Steve Bisciotti, yesterday, saying that they have a nepotism rule that likely would have made it impossible for Dean Pease to work with his son, which is, he's of course coming to the Titans staff as a quality control coach. It read, I didn't see the comments live, but in print it reads like kind of a shot. It's an interesting situation that they've got. You're bringing one coach out of retirement, and the arguably the most important coach that you had to hire this offseason was the offensive coordinator, who doesn't have any experience, and Matt LaFleur doesn't have any experience calling plays, but he's got quite an impressive track record of working with quarterbacks in some of the best seasons that they've had in their careers. So, Luke would probably speak better to this than I would because he's just been around it longer, but I don't really know if there's a situation quite like the Tennessee Titans have with this new coaching staff.
Is that a subtle shot at my age, Buck?
That's right.
Oh, well, appreciate that. Yeah, I kind of miss your face here in studio. you know, the whole thing about Matt LaFleur not calling plays, just touched on that for a second. I don't think that's a big deal in my mind.
Right.
I think that he's coming from a system that really was built around the skill set of Jared Goff and helping him ease into his season as far as making easy throws. And really, ultimately, if you look at what the offense did in Los Angeles under Sean McVay last year, they just tried continuously to get the ball to their best player, and that's Todd Gurley. And
certainly,
I think it's a really simple concept, but I think it's something that can work here in Tennessee. And I'm really, really, really excited, and that's a lot of it really, but I'm really excited. I'm really excited to have an offensive-minded guy like LaFleur, who's now your coordinator, coming out and talking about the fundamentals and footwork. Because if you know anything, and I know you do, this whole last year we harped on the footwork. I did, especially harped on the footwork of Marcus Mariota how I thought it was poor and how I thought that set precedent for his poor play this season and how he lost the whole offseason of not being able to work on his fundamentals. And to have that be one of the first things out of your offensive coordinator's mouth, I think is monumentally big for the development of Marcus Mariota. We've talked about the development. That's been a reoccurring theme the last few years, is when is he going to take that big step? It's supposed to be the third year. Didn't happen this year. We saw regression. We now have a guy that understands the quarterbacking position to the point where he's talking about, let's start with footwork. Let's start with fundamentals. And Buck, I can't emphasize how important that's going to be for this Titans team and for this offense, because we all know it all starts with the quarterback in the NFL. And for quarterbacks, it all starts with your base and your footwork.
Well, and Matt LaFleur is not the only one preaching fundamentals. I mean, that is Mike Vrabel's whole mantra, that, you know, it's almost more important to be fundamentally sound than it is to be athletically gifted. The new quarterbacks coach, Pat O'Hara, said the same thing of Vrabel, that he preaches fundamentals to the extent that it is almost as important as your natural ability. And that's one of the biggest mistakes that I think Mike Mularkey's staff made with Marcus Mariota. They treated him primarily as an athlete first and then as a quarterback second. They seem to want to use his natural abilities more than, I think anybody would deem necessary. And so what you're saying about LaFleur is absolutely, you know, it's very promising. It's the only concerns that I have with him is, and let's not take anything away from Matt LaFleur. I don't mean to do that. After his first media availability, but with the Rams offense, they did go from worst to first in points. I think that's only been done one other time in NFL history. But what they were doing in Los Angeles was, before the 15-second mark on the play clock, they would have Jared Goff at the line of scrimmage, because the coach to quarterback communication in Goff's helmet would shut off before the 15-second mark. Sean McVay, the head coach of the Los Angeles Rams, was helping Goff audible at the line of scrimmage before the 15-second mark. And so that's the only reason that I have some trepidation, if any, with what LaFleur is going to be able to do, because I just don't know how much he really had to do with the in-game success of the Los Angeles Rams. Obviously, he's part of the install, and he's part of, you know, what they do in practice on a day-by-day basis. It's just I've never seen anything like what they were doing in Los Angeles this season, and that's the only reason that I would have any trepidation at all. But yeah, no, what I think is as promising as anything with this coaching staff is that Mike Vrabel didn't hire a bunch of his buddies. I mean, LaFleur said that he had not met Vrabel or Pat O'Hara, the quarterback's coach, prior to this process. And this, I mean, the coaching staff's backgrounds, you know, vary from first NFL head coaching gigs, two of them, Tony Dews and Terry Coombs, the running back and secondaries coach, to a bunch of really experienced NFL coaches, position coaches, who have been in the league for some 20 years, some 6 years across the board, and some who have just gotten their first NFL head coaching gigs. I mean, it's really a varied staff. And I think that, well, for now, that bodes well, just because you'll have a different amount of experience and opinions that'll be able to go into this season. And it'll be, you know, I think that's a good thing to have a varied amount of opinions and experience across the board.
Buck Rising joining us here, covering the Tennessee Titans here for ESPN 102.5 The Game. Buck, from a roster standpoint, what is Matt LaFleur and John Robinson and Mike Vrabel, what are their priorities on this offense as far as roster goes this offseason?
Well, they really wouldn't speak to that too terribly much. It's not like we didn't try to get it out of them. They were more focused yesterday on saying, you know, we're not able to obviously get these guys in the building and work on football stuff quite yet. It's just because of the communication rules in the NFL during the offseason. They really wouldn't commit to any kind of, you know, specificity in terms of personnel. They're just trying to look at what they have right now and start from there, because obviously half of them just got into the building. I don't even know if these people have places to live in Nashville yet.
Well, tell me what you think, Buck. That's why I've got you on the radio show. I want to know where you think they need to address issues.
Oh, well, that's not what you asked me.
Fair enough.
Buck is a wordsmith. Very literal here.
Well, what I think they need to do, I mean, a lot of your key pieces are already in place. And what's more important is the key pieces that are in place are cheap. The quarterback is cheap. The wide receivers are cheap because you've just gotten them on the roster, at least the primary wide receivers. Obviously, you need to add somebody with speed. Taywan Taylor was supposed to be a wide receiver in that mold. He had trouble ingratiating himself into the system. You don't know whether that was, now that we look back on it and see the offensive struggles that we have, we don't know whether that was coaching or whether that was just his inability to adapt to the college game quite as quickly as you would have hoped. But they really don't have any game-breaking speed on offense. And then you obviously have the issue of the two guards who are going to be, Klein is a free agent. I don't think you can pay him. You can draft somebody cheaper at that position. So from an offensive standpoint, I really just think you need somebody with some kind of speed on that offense other than the quarterback or the first-round rookie corner that you try to use on gadget plays.
Buck, a couple questions on the defensive side of the ball here for you. What do you think our new defensive coordinator brings to that unit? And what do you expect to see differently from last year's defense and the things we've seen in the past under the old regime?
Well, it's interesting because with Dean Pease coming out of retirement, it's not like he left a bad gig in Baltimore. I mean, they led the league in turnovers. They were one of the most impressive defenses on paper this season, if not the most impressive defense on paper, other than Jacksonville or what Philadelphia did, even though they just got torched by a 41-year-old quarterback for 505 yards to the air. In terms of what Dean Pease brings that is different from LeBeau. LeBeau runs a ton of man coverage. You leave your secondary kind of out on an island more than necessary just because he likes to blitz with, you know, a fair amount of regularity. So I would expect that there would be more disguise, I would say, with how the defense is schemed. Dean Pease likes to run a lot of different concepts. Vrabel, in his introductory press conference, was preaching front multiplicity. So it's not this, you're not really going to have any kind of set base defense rather than just, you know, saying that they're going to be a 3-4 or a 4-3 or something of the like. They are going to implement as many packages as possible, given whatever limitations they may have with personnel, obviously. But I think there's going to be a good deal more disguise to do what Baltimore was able to do last season, and that's confuse quarterbacks and turn the ball over with much more regularity than they did. Because other than Kevin Byard, guys, I mean, there really wasn't anybody turning the ball over for the Tennessee Titans last season.
Buck Rising, always a pleasure, man. You can follow him on Twitter, at Buck Rising, covering the Titans for 102.5 The Game. Appreciate it, buddy. Thanks a lot, man.
Always a pleasure. Miss you, Luke.
There
you go,
Buck.
You got a shout-out. I like that. All right, Buck. See you later. I don't miss you. Be good.
Yeah, congrats on the new show, Buck.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you. when we come back, we'll get into what Matt LaFleur said yesterday. The most important thing you need to know about what he said yesterday and what it means for Marcus Mariota. Well, ESPN 102.5 The Game is your flagship station for the reigning Western Conference champions, the Nashville Predators. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter and like us on Facebook to keep up with all things in Smashville. Twitter at 102.5 The Game, Instagram at The Game Nashville, Facebook.com/The Game Nashville, at The Luke Rogers, at Braden Gall, Chase McCabe producing. At Chase on Game, well done. Does intern Calvin have a Twitter account or do we not care? We don't care.
We don't care.
Okay. All right, so Dean Pease, defensive coordinator, spoke to the media yesterday, said that his top two reasons to come for taking the job was, A, number one, Mike Vrabel. The opportunity to coach with a guy he knew very well and coached as a coach in New England was an opportunity he didn't want to pass up. And then, of course, Nashville, the city, he cited as a second reason he wanted to come here. It's too much awesomeness in this city, especially the driving and the rubber.
I want to say except for that, yes.
Also, he said he alluded to the arrow on the Titans roster, the trajectory being in a positive direction, which is probably fair, and I think that's the right thing to say as well. So that's why Dean Pease is here. Well, Matt LaFleur's job here is to change the quarterback and to fix the quarterback, or not fix, but evolve the offense and develop the quarterback. This was Matt LaFleur's comment yesterday on what it takes to play quarterback in the NFL.
There's really three, I call them, prerequisites to play in the position. Is number one, you got to be a natural thrower. You better be fearless in the pocket, be able to stand in there. And then the last one is just those intangibles. And I think he possesses all of those. And so some of the things that we'll work on with him is just, and you never know what a guy's been taught in the past, but we're going to be extremely detailed with his fundamentals and his footwork. And just because I think that leads to more consistent quarterback play.
So there are the three things that Matt LaFleur believes it takes to play quarterback in the NFL. You have to be a natural thrower. Mm-hmm. You have to be fearless in the pocket, and you got to have intangibles. Does Marcus Mariota, in your opinion, have those three things?
Yes, no, yes. I think he does have a live arm, and that's important. I mean, although we have seen quarterbacks in this league succeed without having great arms. Peyton Manning, at the very end of his career, had a noodle. Chad Pennington, super accurate, super efficient. No arm. It's important to have a big arm, but that doesn't do everything for you. And yes, he has the intangibles. He's athletic. He sees the field well. He moves well. He makes plays. He throws touchdowns to himself sometimes. Those are all things you can't teach. Is he good in the pocket? I would say no, he's not. At least it wasn't this last season. And we talked about this at nauseam over the season about how he, at least from my point of view, he looked at the pass rush too much. He didn't slide up the pocket. He didn't move well. His footwork was bad. He didn't feel pressure. He left the pocket too early or didn't break the pocket at all when he needed to break the pocket. That was a major, major problem for Marcus Mariota.
Maybe wasn't given great pockets to begin with?
Well, that's true. But there's quarterbacks that have good pocket presence and do well in the pocket that have worse offensive lines. So I'm not going to give him a pass.
So you think it's on Marcus then?
I think a lot of it is.
Okay.
And I think it's tough to measure, but I think a lot of what we saw, I'd say a portion of what we saw this last season had to do with the fact that he was injured the year before and he didn't completely trust his legs after the injury. Now, given he was in completely archaic offense under Rubisky and Mike Mularkey, and now he's got a guy coming from a system that was built around the strengths of Jared Goff in Los Angeles. And I love the idea that you build around your strengths. So you plug round pegs into round holes and not the opposite. I thought they did a lot of that with Marcus last year under Mike Mularkey, asked him to do things that were sort of out of his skill set, where he was best. And we saw him good. He was very good a lot of times in the no huddle, and for a number of reasons. But when it comes down to it, and I love what LaFleur said, it is about footwork and fundamentals. And now Marcus not being injured, not going into this offseason with an injury to rehab from, has the opportunity to work on his craft through the offseason, through OTAs, through preseason, camp, all of that. And I think LaFleur has it right in the sense that that needs to be the priority, because any great quarterback, you ask anybody who succeeded at playing the toughest position in sports, which is playing quarterback in the NFL, and ask them what was the most important thing fundamentally, foundationally for you in succeeding, they'll say it all starts with your feet. And Marcus's feet, frankly, weren't very good last year.
Now, I don't think Marcus's feet will ever be prototypical. He's never going to be the Peyton Manning true drop back, 3-5-7 step drop, plant, drive, throw, you know, whatever, 22-yard out route. That's never going to be his thing, because he's too good of an athlete for that. So he's always going to be moving a little quickly. He's always sort of a back foot thrower. And I think obviously getting some of that out of his game is the job for Matt LaFleur here. But I do think that when you look at the three things he talks about, I agree with you. I think he's got I think his arm is perfectly fine. It's more than adequate. It's more than strong. It's more than accurate. I think it's just fine. The intangibles are through the roof. I think that's bullet point one and three on Matt LaFleur's checklist here. And I think he's got the intangibles that are off the charts. His competitive nature, his leadership, his poise, all that stuff are the intangibles. His football IQ. I mean, you don't lead a team on a comeback in the second half against Kansas City like that and not have some idea how to play the game just naturally. Yeah. Those are just sort of God-given intangibles, and I think he's got those in spades. The middle one, and I think he said it in a weird way because he said fearless in the pocket. I think you just need to call it pocket presence and feel your surroundings better. Tom Brady's not a great athlete, but he feels the pocket better than anybody
he
we've
moves
ever seen.
Well. He slides.
And it's tiny movements. Yep, it's tiny little steps here or wiggles there or a shuffle here, and all of a sudden he's got space and time to make a play. And so I do think that is where Marcus is at his weakest from a fundamental development standpoint. But I don't know if he's ever going to be that true drop-back guy. Now, he's great under center, better than we anticipated, and he's great in the play action. He's the best quarterback in the NFL in play action. So that plays itself into this sort of pocket role, because play action, in theory, other than a bootleg or some rollout, most of your play action is done inside the pocket. Almost all RPOs are done inside the pocket. And by the way, not every play action fake is an RPO.
We need to tell people. People go wild with
Collinsworth said there were like 37 RPOs in the game, and I was like, there's like six of them. Anyway, I think Marcus has all the things that Matt LaFleur is looking for, but I do think that middle one is the one we need to work on. You just talked about it. That's the one that Marcus is going to have to develop. And I think, again, if I'm looking back last year and putting blame on Marcus for that part of his game, I think some of it goes to an interior of the offensive line where they went up against the Aaron Donalds of the world and the pocket got destroyed because the interior of the offensive line wasn't protecting him. He didn't have his number one receiver for most of the season. His number one running back was injured for most of the season. I just think things around him, you mentioned the archaic offensive system. I think that's a part of this as well. I don't really know if we know what Marcus really is yet.
Yeah, I think we do.
That's why we're excited to see what Matt LaFleur can do, because that might actually show us his full potential.
Yeah, and we're going to find out, because I think he finally has the things in place, the pieces in place. And, you know, I know John Robinson is going to look at what happened last year in the offensive line, and he's going to act accordingly. He's done that every season to improve the roster, to churn in a way not unlike the New England Patriots do, to churn the bottom part of that roster, to bring in better players, to improve things, and to build around your star players. And here's the thing, too, with this offense that really bothered me last year, is I just felt like you didn't build around Marcus Mariota's skill set. And it'd be exciting to see a coordinator and a coach that I believe are really going to try to put him in the best position to succeed. That's what coaches do. We talk about how big of an impact a coach makes, you know, on an NFL team. And I think the biggest impact they make is they put their playmakers and their players in the best positions to succeed. They can't make plays for them. They can't go out there and catch the ball, throw the ball, run the ball. But you put your guy in the best situation. I don't think Marcus Mariota was put in the best position with his skill set to succeed under Mike Mularkey. And I believe he's going to get a shot.
I don't think you really don't have to look far in the NFL to see what a good offensive coaching staff can do with players. You merely have to watch the last football game that was played. And you can look at an undrafted running back out of Wisconsin named Corey Clement, yep. A guy they traded for in the middle of the season in Jay Ajayi, a guy they got off the free agent scrap heap in LeGarrette Blount. Zach Ertz was a big draft pick. That was a high draft pick. They spent equity on him. Torrey Smith is a guy that essentially has been around the league and is a journeyman.
Right.
Alshon Jeffrey was a free agent pickup that they got, you know, and then re-signed him because
it's like a 1-year deal.
There were issues with him. Like, there's always, even going back to South Carolina, there's issues with Alshon Jeffrey playing hard every play. So there's a bunch of, I'm not saying they aren't talented. They're very talented. The Eagles are, and the backup quarterback, by the way,
right.
Nick Foles.
Yeah.
But the point is that that's not exactly a collection of elite level draft picks that Doug Peterson just turned into Super Bowl champions.
Right.
That's what a great coaching staff can do for a bunch of players who are good. Almost everybody in the NFL is good at this point. You get to that level, you're good. The question is, can you be great? And that's where the coaching staff takes you to another level. Doug Peterson did that with the Eagles staff and with those players. Can Matt LaFleur do that with this team? We'll find out. There are some nice pieces to work with. And Buck said it. There's already some cornerstone pieces in place. Left tackle, right tackle, quarterback, tight end. You've got some studs to work around. Put some more pieces in there and put the coaching staff in there, and we'll see what happens. Speaking of adding pieces, National Signing Day yesterday, Josh Ward will join us from WNML. Coming up next, how good a job did Jeremy Pruitt do closing on the recruiting trail for the Tennessee Volunteers? And maybe a little hoop as well. Tennessee Vols looking good right now. So we'll talk with Josh Ward when we come back. Luke Rogers, Braden Gall, ESPN 102.5 The Game. ESPN 102.5 The Game, Luke Rogers and Braden Gall here on The Morning Show.
Yeah, we are.
Josh Ward joining us from WNML in Knoxville at Josh_Ward. Josh, how are you, sir? Welcome to the program.
Yeah, doing well. Great to be with you guys.
So, recruiting, National Signing Day, Jeremy Pruitt. I did not expect the Tennessee Vols to close big with any names on the top of their board. However, I did expect something to happen. How would you describe yesterday for the Tennessee Vols in recruiting on National Signing Day?
I would describe yesterday, just Wednesday, the day itself, as a disappointment for Tennessee, because Tennessee went into the day on the board with so many big-time prospects that Tennessee had aggressively pursued and tried to sign and really didn't sign any of them. Now, J.J. Peterson is a big-time player that Tennessee signed yesterday, and he had been committed for a month. So that is a four-star linebacker that Alabama won and Tennessee got him. So he's a nice addition. All the other players, though, that were more undecided going into signing day decided to go elsewhere. And I think in some positions where Tennessee had a really big need, the Vols kind of came up short. And there's just a lot of work to be done on the roster. Jeremy Pruitt at his press conference was asked specifically about the cornerback position, and it was described to him in the question as a need. Pruitt's response was, well, who said it was a need? And my answer would be Tennessee's coaching staff, because they offered a ton of cornerbacks, and all of the ones that they aggressively went after went elsewhere. So the class itself is okay. I would be with you. I didn't expect a huge finish, but considering who Tennessee went after and all the guys they didn't get, yesterday was a little disappointing for Tennessee.
Josh Ward joining us here, WNML. I know too much is made of one class, especially on a after the early signing period with a new coaching staff. What would be a reasonable expectation for Tennessee Volunteer football recruiting in next year's cycle?
That's a good question. I think the expectation will be very high, and I think that's pretty reasonable considering the staff Jeremy Pruitt has put together has largely been based around going out and recruiting the Southeast. With the different coaches that have come on board and the connections that they have to SEC schools, a lot of guys that he has connections to, having worked with them or been around them, guys that have been on staff at Georgia and Florida and Florida State, their goal next year is to go sign as good of a class as they can and try to do something like what we're seeing right now from Georgia and Alabama and Clemson and Ohio State. Now, what makes that difficult is that those schools are going to keep the same expectations as well. But I think next year Tennessee tries to sign a top five to top seven class. And there is kind of a comparison to Butch Jones. When he took over, he had a class that they were in on some big-time players at the end, but didn't really sign those guys. Somebody like Von Bell, who ended up going to Ohio State. Tennessee hoped to land him on signing day. Didn't. The next year, Tennessee had a top five class. And I would say that Tennessee fans will expect Jeremy Pruitt to do something like that, go sign a top five level class. Easier said than done, but that's what Tennessee's going to have to do if it's realistically going to try to close that gap between Georgia and Alabama, two teams that Tennessee faces every year. The scary part is you have all these other first-year coaches that have plans to do the exact same thing, and that's who Tennessee's going to have to go up against.
Josh, question for you about this down recruiting class. Do you think it speaks more to just the short amount of time that Pruitt had to really turn this around, or his staff as a whole, or maybe the perception of the program? Which do you think played more into it being a down year for the Tennessee Vols recruiting, as we talk about it needing to be a very much an up year next year?
Well, it's a good question. I would say my first response would be kind of the perception of the program. If you're trying to beat out Georgia for Quay Walker, it's pretty understandable why Georgia wins the battle. Or if you're trying to beat out Georgia for Tyson Campbell, Georgia wins that one. Alabama brings in Eddie Smith, the cornerback that Tennessee thought it was going to land, and he goes to Tuscaloosa. Change of plans. He's going to sign with Alabama. And Tennessee lost a couple guys to Florida State. That's a program that's in better shape. Timing wouldn't be an issue there with Florida State because Willie Taggart arrived there in Tallahassee after Jeremy Pruitt took over at Tennessee, and Tennessee lost two guys on signing day to the Seminoles, one that Tennessee kind of discovered in Jordan Young. So timing's not an issue there. That's maybe a factor in that Tennessee went after all of these highly touted guys from all over the place, and a few guys from California, Elijah Griffin and Isaac Taylor Stewart, who decided to stay in California and sign with USC. If Tennessee had a year to try to convince Quay Walker to go to Tennessee instead of Georgia, to try to convince Jacob Copeland to play at Tennessee instead of Florida, the Vols probably win one or two of those battles instead of going 0-for. But I would say the state of the program is still the biggest question that Tennessee has to answer for highly touted recruits that have a chance to go anywhere in the country.
Josh Ward joining us here, WNML in Knoxville, at Josh_Ward. You can follow him there on the Twitters. Tennessee takes on Alabama in basketball. I don't know if you noticed this, but Auburn lost last night, and Tennessee basketball is within one game of first place in the SEC.
It's wild. It really is. And Auburn does have that head-to-head win against Tennessee, but right now the Vols feel like they can beat anybody, and why shouldn't they think that? And the league, as strong as it is and as deep as it is, talking about the SEC, Tennessee's been, over the last few weeks, the most consistent team, you would say, in the league. You would have said going into last night, Tennessee and Auburn, then Auburn loses the game. It's remarkable. I know everybody's pointing this out, that as strong as the league is, as strong as we've seen in a long time, that two teams that got almost no attention at the start of the year, Auburn and Tennessee, the attention Auburn got was for off the court, not what was going to happen on it. It's remarkable, but Tennessee getting that win at Rupp Arena is just such a big deal. I mean, you can go with just the resume talk and what it means to go sweep Kentucky and win in Rupp Arena. That's going to look great when the selection committee is looking at Tennessee and its schedule that it's played. But Tennessee has continued to show that it can play with just about anybody. It has that win against Purdue in the Bahamas. And then to get the wins that it's gotten recently, now 9 of the last 10, Tennessee still went into Rupp thinking, we need to prove something. And I think that happened to hit a big shot late, get a big defensive stop, and history says Kentucky's going to win that game. And somehow Tennessee, not even playing its best basketball, I wouldn't even say close to it, got the win. And coming out of the weekend, there was some national talk of could Tennessee make a run at a number one seed. It still, to me, seems like a little bit of a long shot, but it's a realistic conversation now, and it's a conversation I can't believe we're having and never would have even brought up just 2 months ago.
Do you think this team can get to that two line? Because I think the two line puts them in Nashville. I think if they can get to that two seed, they can come here potentially. Does that feel right to you?
Yeah, I think that's a very real possibility, because coming out of this past weekend, we looked at the remaining schedule for Tennessee and look at the league. Tennessee could hit a rough stretch and lose a couple of games in a row or two out of three, and it could hold Tennessee where it is right now. But right now, Tennessee is maybe more in that three seed line. So could Tennessee move up? Sure, because the Kentucky game looked like the most difficult game remaining, having to go to Rupp. Now, Alabama on the road is not going to be easy this week. Florida at home, despite some of the Gator struggles. It's still going to be a challenging game. You have to go to the two Mississippi schools back-to-back, and that isn't necessarily easy, even though you're probably the better team than Mississippi State, and you definitely are than compared to Ole Miss. But just to answer your question, yeah, I mean, I think anything's in play at this point. And in college basketball, we've seen teams that look like they were going to be power teams at the beginning of the season that have gone through rough stretches. We're now 23 games into Tennessee's season, and we've yet to see them really hit a difficult stretch. They've gotten better as the season's gone along, and the players deserve a ton of credit for that because they played well on both ends. The offense gets a lot of attention when guys hit shots, but Tennessee's defense, I think, is the biggest reason that the Vols are 18-5 right now and only a game out of first place in the SEC.
Josh, always a pleasure, man. Thanks a lot, dude. We appreciate it.
Hey, you got it. Thanks a lot, guys.
Josh Ward, WNML. Tennessee right now, bracketology came out today. We'll get to what those seeds are when we come back because there's a lot of SEC seeding that's going on right now.
And are the Vols in a huge weekend possibly coming to Nashville?
Yeah, they're very close, and I'll tell you how close they are because the bracketology came out today, and it's closer than you think. We'll explain when we come back right here. Luke Rogers, Braden Gall, ESPN 102.5 The Game. You're listening to 102.5 live from the Game Nashville Studios, presented by Wholesale Inc. of Mount Juliet. The Luke Rogers, Braden Gall here. And bracketology came out today. By the way, Villanova lost last night, number one. You got Purdue losing last night.
Hey, Villanova lost to Chris Mullen and his incredible flat top.
I love your analysis. You go right to like the coach's haircut. That's right. You can't get that anywhere else.
Right. I mean, right, if we were ranking college football teams, it'd be Gundy's, Oklahoma State,
just mullets.
Cowboys would be number one.
Just mullets, yeah. Number one for you. Yeah. Okay,
100%.
I like a man of integrity who at least is willing to admit that he's only going to rank your football team based on your coach's haircut. I think that's tremendous.
I think it's like picking a racehorse.
I think you belong on the committee, actually.
You know, you pick a racehorse by its name? I mean, come on. You pick a team by its coach's hair.
So Tennessee plays at Alabama over the weekend. You got Kentucky going on the road against Texas A&M. You got a ton of teams in the SEC on the bubble. The bracketology came out today. Missouri's an 8 seed right now. Alabama's a 9 seed right now. You've got Arkansas as a 10 seed in the NCAA tournament. You've got Kentucky as a 5 seed in the NCAA tournament. You've got, let's see here, Auburn as a 3 seed, first place in the SEC. Florida is a 7 seed in the SEC tournament. A&M as a 9 seed in the SEC or in the NCAA tournament. And the Tennessee Volunteers as a 3 seed playing in Pittsburgh. And if you are a 3 seed at this stage of the season, then the 2 line is well within reach.
Sure is.
And if you get to the 2 line, you are probably playing in Nashville. I don't think they can get to the 1 line. That seems almost insane about. And even a 2 seed seems insane to think about. But if you get to the 2 seed, which is within reach now, because Auburn's the 3 seed, they just lost last night.
Right.
Tennessee's a 3 seed. Their schedule's easier. I know Auburn has the head-to-head, but could Tennessee get to that 2 line with some marquee W's? Yes. I can't believe I'm saying it, but the answer is yes, and they would come here to Nashville.
Yeah.
Where the building would be packed.
Yeah, it'd be amazing. And it's a weird year for college basketball. There really aren't any powerhouse teams that are really running through the regular season schedule, and Tennessee's got as good a shot as any. If they can stay the course here, and I mean possibly even win that SEC tournament, we're looking at a team that can be realistically a 2 seed. They just gotta do what they do. They gotta get out there and they gotta handle business. And that's a tough thing. We saw what happened last night with Texas A&M beating Auburn, and Auburn has been as good as they've been since 1999 this season under Bruce Pearl. And a big year for the SEC in basketball. A lot of teams.
Eight,
right? You just
eight
named
teams
up,
right now.
Yeah,
eight teams.
That seems unheard of. This is a football conference, right?
I don't know, not anymore.
Yeah, not anymore. So, yeah, Tennessee's got a real legit chance, and like you said, it would be bonkers here in Nashville if the Vols were playing tournament games here in the city.
And right now, this is Joe Lunardi, bracketology. He's got last four in Washington, NC State, Houston, and USC. Arkansas, Providence, Virginia Tech, and Kansas State, the next one's in. So even Arkansas has some space there. They can afford.
I mean,
they're clearly on the bubble, but like Missouri's as a 9 seed, and Florida's a 7, and A&M is a 9. Like these guys have space, so they've actually got room to maneuver. A&M is dangerous as they get healthy. They're going to keep winning, and that's a dangerous team. They play Kentucky this weekend. That will be a fascinating game to see where both teams are at mentally. A&M is good enough to smoke Kentucky.
Yeah.
Kentucky's good enough to beat anybody.
Yeah, Kentucky's also, the weirdest team. They really are. They really are talented enough to beat anybody in the nation, and yet they're so young. They haven't been able to put it together. And yeah, they are young. They're young and inexperienced, and it's a Calipari team. But Calipari's found ways, though, to take teams like this and get them to gel for the tournament. So scary team, you put them at 5, scary team at 6, scary team at 4, wherever you want to put them.
We talked about this when the SEC came out like 2 years ago, and they said, we're going to make a concerted effort to get good at basketball. We're going to hire a guy from the Big East to come in and be a consultant. We're going to hire this. We're going to do that. We're going to be good at basketball. And we all said, okay, SEC, good for you. Like, that's funny.
Good for you.
Good for you, SEC. Aw. And yeah. Now look at them. And I'm not suggesting that there's other factors at work, but hiring coaches is the number one factor, and it's what we talk about with SEC football. Every single time we talk about the SEC and we go, why isn't the SEC as dominant in football as it used to be when it was winning 7 or 8 straight national titles with 3 or 4 different teams? It's the coaches.
Yeah.
It was the coaches. And the coaches are the issue in football, and now the coaches are the reason the SEC is back in basketball.
Yeah.
It's why we have 8 teams in the tournament. It's why Missouri is in the tournament right now.
Yeah, Rick Barnes.
It's why Florida lost Billy Donovan and is still still a competitive high-level SEC team.
Yeah.
Because they hired the right guys.
Yeah, and you know what? And I think we beat this to a pulp before, but the SEC had a run of hiring a lot of glorified coordinators for a while, and they paid for it in the football aspect. And yeah, coaches are interesting. We talked about the coaching when we talked about Marcus Mariota, like how big of an impact does a coach have? And obviously, not taking shots, not dribbling the ball, not catching the ball, not throwing the ball, but it makes a huge difference in. You know, in putting your players in the right position to make plays when it matters. And that's what Bruce Pearl, Rick Barnes, and the like here in the SEC basketball world have been able to do. And it speaks for itself. 8, 9 teams possibly in the tournament here.
And I know that I've been on record as saying I don't see the upside in the NCAA tournament for Tennessee. It doesn't mean it's a run isn't possible. They're playing with so much confidence right now. They play great defense. These are things that travel in the NCAA tournament. They're not an overly talented team. This is not a team that's loaded with NBA draft lottery picks. It's just not. I mean, that's the difference between this Tennessee team and other 2 and 3 seeds in the country. Is they just don't have the same number. But to win in the first weekend, you don't have to be.
No.
I think this team is clearly a second weekend team. There's no question about it. The question, though, is how deep can they go? How good really are they?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still in a wait-and-see mode. I'm still not willing to say that this team has the elite-level upside of some of the other more talented teams that are around them. And that is... That has always been the question with this team. That's why they were picked 13th in the preseason, is because they didn't have the bodies. They didn't have the Jimmys and the Joes. And while they've got a bunch of guys that are pretty good, I'm not sure they've got an elite player, especially on the perimeter, that can carry them to a huge win against a high-quality opponent in the second weekend. And that's weeks down the road, so we don't have to worry about it. Just enjoy the ride right now. Go out and beat Alabama this weekend. You know, that's a tough game. As Josh said, you got Florida coming up. You've got the Mississippi schools on the road. Those are tough games. You got to take care of business. And if you do that, you get to the 2 line and you come here,
right
to Nashville,
play a home game, man.
Place will go crazy, man, and it really will.
The thing too is that if there's a season for a team that doesn't have a superstar to make a run deep, it's this year with just how wide open college basketball is.
You excited about Duke, North Carolina tonight?
I am. I love that rivalry.
It's shocking how that always comes up the week after the Super Bowl.
This is probably about the time I start watching college basketball, to be honest.
Isn't everybody?
I mean, obviously,
I'm sort of a junk. I'm not as big a nerd as like Julian Council is, but like I sort of peek in on basketball. I watch it and I keep an eye on it, and then all of a sudden, it gets to this time, and the whole country is full force.
Yeah.
And that's the reason. There's a reason that the Masters is on the weekend after the NCAA tournament.
Yeah.
There's a reason that Duke, North Carolina. Is all the first meeting is always the week of after the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
They want to keep you tuned in. I mean, there's
100%.
It's obvious.
They're messing with your brain.
Well, Duke North Carolina is big tonight. Also, while you're out watching Duke North Carolina, don't miss our Predators watch party tonight at Frisky Frogs on DeMumbry. You can see all of the games from all of the sports. Jared and the GM will be broadcasting live from 2 to 6 while the game. We'll be hanging out afterwards until 8 p.m. as your Nashville Predators take on Eastern Conference foe Ottawa. Plus, you'll have a chance to win tickets to an upcoming Preds home game. They're playing the Senators tonight. Just a reminder, by the way, sort of an interesting, quirky, weird start time. Pre-game at 5:30. puck drop at 6:30, just like last night. Back to the regularly scheduled time, I believe, on Saturday against Montreal. But tonight against Ottawa, 6:30 puck drop. Of course, every second right here on ESPN 102.5, the game. So just a reminder there, 6:30 start time.
It's a good reminder.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll be watching.
I'm a man of the people. Luke Rogers, Braden Gall. When we come back, another man of the people. Steve Cavendish going to join us, former editor of the Nashville Scene. We'll talk all things Titans, Preds, maybe even some Cruton. Who knows? We'll talk with Steve when we come back right here on ESPN 102.5 The Game.